The Weekly Connect
on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Weekly Connect. I am Stephen Scott and this is your place to talk about all the issues that matter to you if you're blind or partially sighted. Welcome to The Weekly Connect. And on this week's programme, one of the subjects we talked about a few weeks ago, the state of the UK roads. Well, Julie Bennett has been in touch to tell us her experience of travelling around her local area. And actually, for once, it's a positive story. Didn't start positive, but it certainly has a bit of a positive outcome. Hear her story coming up. And also, getting into employment. Alex Mackey joins us to talk about getting into employment and getting into, in particular, self-employment. It's a story that you will want to hear. And it's all change at RNIB. But what does Sally Harvey, acting CEO, have to say about those changes? Well, we want your views. We're going to hear from Sally Harvey this week, and then we're going to hear more from you on your thoughts on the changes coming to the UK's leading sight loss charity. And once again, we hand the microphone to you in the book group.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
So welcome along once again to another of the Weekly Connect programmes. You, of course, have been listening and getting in touch in your droves. Thank you for doing that. And also being able to shape the conversation, which is what this programme is all about. And interestingly, that's where we begin, shaping conversation. Now, it is not often the case that we think we have the ability to change much in our lives. A lot of services that are delivered to us are kind of delivered without much of our say. But what if you could change all that? What if you could actually have a say in the services delivered to you from, say, an eye hospital? Well, that's exactly what Moorfields Eye Hospital are asking you to do. And this week, we're going to find out more about it and find out why they are asking for your help for their five-year strategy.
My name's Jo Moss. I'm the Director of Strategy and Business Development at Moorfields Eye Hospital.
My name's Irene Akeshis. I'm currently a patient at Moorfields, but I'm also the director of an organisation called New Citizenship Project, which is aiming to involve people more in society as citizens.
Tell us why you're here today. Tell us about what this is all about.
So at Moorfields, we are in the process of reviewing and refreshing our organisational strategy. So that's really going to help us think about what we're doing, why we do what we do, and what our priorities are going forward. And we're really keen to involve patients in this process and hear from patients about what they think our strategy and our priorities should be, so that we can learn from them and incorporate their ideas in our strategy going forward.
If you don't mind me asking, Joe, you know, why have you decided to do this now?
I think we recognise that we want to listen to patients, we want to hear from them, and so it's really important to make sure that we engage patients. So we're engaging with them at this point in the process because we've already done some thinking internally and we feel that we're at a point now to be able to share with our patients our current thinking and get them to test it, to challenge it and help us shape the strategy before we finalise it and publish it later this year.
And as you say, you're keen to hear from patients. Irene, you are a patient of Moorfields. Tell us your thoughts on the services you've received.
So I've always had an amazing experience at Moorfields. I got an eye infection about 6 years ago, and I was very poorly for quite a long time, and I ended up losing the sight in one eye. My weekly visits to Moorfields were a really important time of my week. And I always just received excellent care. I always received empathetic, excellent, and really compassionate care from the team that were looking after me.
Because it is more than just a medical procedure, isn't it? It's an emotional experience for a lot of people who go into any hospital, I guess. But when it's to do with your eyes, when you know that something is going to happen to you that could have a significant impact on you like that, I guess you need to get that support across the board.
It's incredibly anxiety-inducing going into hospital to have appointments to check on the progress of a condition or a disease that you're experiencing as a patient. So of course when you walk in there's anxiety when you're sat in the waiting room, there's anxiety while the doctor's examining you, and so everything that can be done to make that process a bit easier and a bit more structured for the patients is really helpful. But I think the important thing that I'd want to communicate about this process is that if you involve patients in the conversation about the future direction of the hospital, then you're going to shape a strategy that's been inputted into by everyone, which I think is really exciting.
Joe, I have to say, I think one of the most common criticisms I've ever heard of a hospital is when someone goes into, especially an eye hospital in this case, and learns that they're losing their sight, oftentimes they feel that the response they get from the surgeon or the doctor or whoever it is that's talking to them, consultant, it can be quite cold. It can be a case of, well, that's you, you've lost your sight or you're losing your sight. So, you know, there's the door, if you can find it. You know, it's very difficult, I think, for a lot of people to deal with that. Is that maybe one thing that is that you hope might come out of this, that, you know, that sort of level of understanding of what it means to have sight loss, that emotional aspect to it?
Yes, very much so. Certainly from the people that we've heard from so far, that's a very strong theme. And I think that's, again, particularly why it's important that we do hear from patients. So obviously we have a particular perspective, sitting on the provider side, often the professional, the clinician, and even our administrative staff have a very different perspective of what it's like to experience our services. So that's why we're really keen to hear from patients. What is it like for them as they experience receiving care and treatment? And how can we improve that? What are the things that we're not doing well at the moment that, in terms of our strategy going forward, we need to make sure we're addressing to make that experience much better for our patients?
So the way you want to humanise the service?
Absolutely. Well, we want to hear from patients what is it that we're not getting right at the moment. And certainly, as you said, making it more human, making sure that we understand the wider needs of the people coming through our door are understood and met is certainly an emerging theme. So certainly, if that's something we continue to hear, it will need to be front and centre for our strategy going forward.
Irini, can I ask a bit more about your eye condition and how you learned about it?
So I contracted a very rare but very severe eye infection back in 2011, a disease called acanthamoeba keratitis, which is a mouthful to pronounce, but is mostly associated with contact lens wear. So it's a microbe that lives in water, and when the water comes into contact with contact lenses, it can actually get into the cornea and cause a really awful and in many cases devastating infection. Unfortunately, that's what happened to me. Via that, I started to campaign for greater awareness of the risk factors for this disease in contact lens wearers. So I started a campaign to a no water campaign, which I then won an award for, actually, from the RNIB. Via that, and the support that I'd received from the clinical staff at Moorfields Eye Hospital about raising awareness, I started to get more involved in Moorfields as a patient, if you like. So I helped set up a patient group at Moorfields, started to contribute to research, and started to become much more involved in the work of the hospital more generally, not just in my own care. That was a really amazing experience for me, and it really actually helped me with my recovery, with coping with my disease, and gave me a sense of control over what was happening to me. And I realised actually that patients have a really powerful stake in the work of the hospital, and patients can help shape and improve services in a way that I had never appreciated before. So since then, I've been on a bit of a mission to try and promote this more widely, and the team at Moorfields and Joe in particular has been a real champion of that, and has been a real supporter of patients getting more involved.
That seems to be the key theme here, isn't it? It's getting obviously patients more involved, but as you say, it's those tangible ways that we can do that. Because I guess myself, I'm sitting here thinking, what can I do to help improve a hospital, obviously without going and getting 7 years of medical experience behind me? You know, there's obviously more to it that you can do. And you know, you talk about patient groups, Irini. You know, how important are those, and what have you got out of it, and what do you think others have?
Patient groups are an amazing source of support for those who don't get a lot of information, or people that walk out of a clinic room with a diagnosis and they don't really know what to do next and where to go next. Support, meeting other patients, talking to them about their experiences, understanding what their treatment was like in comparison to yours, finding emotional support and empathy and understanding are all absolutely critical for everyone that's going through a difficulty with their sight or losing their vision. And and the great thing about patient groups is that they're run by patients, that they're established and run by the people who need them the most, which means that usually they deliver the right information in the right kind of way And I think what hospitals can do is support the establishment of those and to help patients to meet and connect with each other.
Joe, I guess you echo all of that, and I guess that prevention is also a big part of all of this. As Irene says, you know, her condition is something that came about as a result of, you know, something that happened that other people could learn from. I guess that patient-to-patient support can help you deliver a better service longer term.
Very much so, yes. I think for too long the NHS has been quite traditional in its approach to supporting patients, and certainly I would reflect from my own experience working with Irene in particular on the strategy, just the huge value that our patients and users can bring in terms of providing a different perspective and really challenging some of our own understanding about what it's like to experience coming to hospital and receiving care. So I'm certainly keen at more fields that we start to think very differently and more expansively about how we listen to our patients, how we engage them in not only conversations about our future strategy, but also how we deliver care on a day-to-day basis and how we can continue to improve that and make it better for patients.
Okay, so Joe, how do people do it then? How do people contribute to your survey, to your questions?
So we've got an online survey at the moment. There are two different versions. So there's a version that is easily accessible that people can use with their technology if they need to. And what we're asking people to do is to go on. It should take no more than 10 minutes to complete, to just provide us some feedback. And then we're also asking particular people if they are interested in coming to a workshop that we're holding at the end of March, where we'll be sitting face to face with patients and staff in the same room to really take forward the conversation about what our future strategy should be at Moorfields.
And Irene, I guess you encourage everyone to get involved.
Yeah, I'd love to see as many people as possible at this workshop at the end of March. I'm really looking forward to sort of chatting with patients and finding out how they can input into the strategy and going forward.
Irene and Joe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you want to take part in that survey, all you've got to do is get in touch with Moorfields Eye Hospital. As you heard there from Joe, it is an online survey. So if you search online for Moorfields Eye Hospital survey, you will get to that. Do check it out online. Do get involved. You know, have your say. That is what it is all about. This is The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio and on podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for downloading. However you're listening to us, thank you for doing it. One of the things that we get a lot of conversation about here on the programme is the state of our roads here in the UK. Some of the roads, you will agree, are pretty bad. And potholes is one thing that gets talked about all the time. It's always in the news about the state of potholes and the roads. But what about side pavements? What about getting around safely? And especially when there's construction work going on, how difficult is it to get around if you don't know the layout of the road, if it's all changed? Well, that is exactly the experience that Julie Bennett had in her local area. And she's on the line now to tell us more about her experience, which apparently turned into quite a bit of a positive.
We've had ongoing roadworks in this particular junction for quite a while now. And it's been fraught with problems of different things. But I went through the normal gap that I would normally go through with my guide dog, Polly, and we got what I thought was halfway across the road, and there was no traffic island. I thought that's strange, but she carried on going. When we got to the other side, there's actually a filter road into the road that was actually crossed off, if you can imagine. It's a crossroads junction. And the filter road was blocked off. It's quite hard to describe, actually, but the filter road was, the whole road was blocked off, and it was blocked off with cones and bollards. But the road leading onto it, the filter road leading onto it, was also blocked off, and there was actually no exit at all whatsoever. So we were sort of cocooned in a matter of cones and bollards. There was no escape, and we couldn't go back onto the road because I didn't know where I was positioned in the road. So of course Polly got us into the bollards and stopped, and then I sort of tried to navigate where I was and backstep towards the bollards. And as we walked along where the railings were, there was just no way out. I was in a horrendous situation to try and find my way out. And then to make it worse, it was a half a, well, I think it was about four four ewes came along and thought it was quite amusing to have a laugh at me walking backwards and forwards, and then decided to throw a couple of stones. One made contact, and I think a couple made contact with Polly. Well, that was the limit then. I was a little bit cross with them. And then a lady and gentleman stopped, obviously on the other side of the junction, and came to my rescue. But they couldn't even get out of the roadworks, and they were sighted. So we actually managed to cross back on the road and then cross further along the road. But there was no indication on the roadworks to where to cross. She crossed in a normal place where they'd left the gap open. However, to cut a long story short, this was on the Sunday evening. On the Monday, I rang the council, and they said to me, "Oh, yes, we've had lots of complaints about that since Thursday. We'll look into it." And I said, "No, I want some action, please." To which they said, "Oh, we'll pass it on." But I actually said to them, "Could you give me the construction workers who's doing the construction?" This is where it turned round and became quite positive, because they actually gave me the construction name, and I got in touch with the construction. And I was very lucky, because I got a gentleman called John Gallagher from Cambrian Way, who were the construction engineers on site, and he was absolutely marvellous. He offered to come down and meet me and take me through the roadworks as they were then, and also as they were going to be when they'd finished the work at the end of this month. And he came down because I'd rang the Champion, our local paper, and they were putting a bit in the paper to thank this lady and gentleman that had stopped to help me. And also I felt that there was praise due to the construction firm and himself, John, as well, because they'd been so positive about helping. And he also said that he would take a group of local visually impaired people around the site as well, which I thought was absolutely positive, because this whole new light was going to be changed. And I just, you know, my attitude is, if you can't get in the front door, knock on the side door and the back door, and you might get in that way. And I think he was so positive and helpful. He definitely was a positive, and there had been so much bad publicity about these roadworks and moans. I think in one quick phone call, he changed the whole attitude of the place by being so helpful. And he even gave me his own personal telephone number, his mobile, to say, "Look, if you're down that way and you need any help, ring me before you get off the bus and I'll help you." I couldn't have expected any more than that from anybody, really. That was more than anyone could expect. And I think if you can negotiate with people, they can be very helpful.
So that's the answer, is it? Just get involved and have a say. Get out there and speak to people. That's exactly what Julie Bennett did. Well, thank you, Julie, for coming on and telling us about that, because, you know, I think a lot of people out there have probably faced similar. I know I have. So, you know, if you face a problem, try and find out who's behind it. If the council can't help you, maybe the construction company that are involved in the work in this case can. And, you know, what a positive result that was, and what a great experience that ended up being for Julie, and meant she could still continue to go out. That's the thing. So, you know, tell us your thoughts on this. If you've had similar experience, I'd love to hear about it. You can email us, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk, or of course you can get in touch via Twitter. We are at RNIB, and when you use Twitter, use the hashtag #TheWeeklyConnect. Now, it's all change at RNIB, apparently, yes. And one of the things that RNIB have been keen to do is express what kind of changes are coming and why. And that is exactly why acting CEO Sally Harvey sat down with Alan Russell this week to tell us more about the changes that are coming and why.
I mean, firstly, I think one of the things that people say, of course, is that change is the one constant. So it may feel that RNIB is constantly changing, but that is always with the intent of reaching more blind and partially sighted people to ensure that we are an organisation that is wholly responsive to the needs of the people we're here to support. So what are those changes? There's two main changes. The first is around simplifying our group structure. So many people still find it very confusing when we talk about Action for Blind People being part of the RNIB group. They don't know whether what that actually means. And yes, we know from the feedback people have given us that it is confusing. So one of the changes we're proposing is to simplify that and bring all those services together under the name of RNIB. So that's change one. The second change is the introduction of a new operating model, a new way of delivering services. What we know is that currently we only directly reach around 100,000 people. Now, in the context of there being around 2 million people living with sight loss, frankly, that's not good enough. And the way that we deliver services at the moment make it very, very difficult for us to expand that reach in a way that is both affordable and scalable.
Okay, now the organisation itself has gone through changes over the past few years, Sally. This, as I said, being the most recent. There's been changes, there have been consultations and so on. Is this particular one more in-depth, more wide-ranging?
I would say yes, certainly wider-ranging, because what we've wanted to do is make sure that the change is holistic, that it ensures that it works as a whole. So blind and partially sighted people aren't left confused or passed between services where it's not clear what we do. So yes, it is a wider change aimed at ensuring that anybody who needs our support or support of others is able to receive that support.
Now, many of our listeners have obviously concerns when things happen to a charity like RNIB, such a high profile charity, which does have a huge impact at improving people's lives who have visual impairments. Their concerns, a lot of that seems to be around perhaps reductions in staff. Will that affect frontline services? Will there be any contractions in the services? Are any of those things that people should be concerned about, or are there ways that RNIB are handling this to keep frontline services really as they are, if not better?
We certainly don't want blind and partially sighted people left concerned about the services they receive as a result of this change. And certainly we have no intention of simply abandoning people or stopping delivering services. So what the changes are, however, is ensuring that the way we deliver services enable more people to be reached, and bringing services together in a different way will enable us to do that. We then want to ensure that, particularly with some of the more specialist services that we deliver, that actually they're the right ones, the ones that are going to make the difference, biggest difference to people, and also ensuring that we respect the services that are delivered by others, ensuring that blind and partially sighted people are equally benefiting from other people's services as well as our own. So no, nothing about this change is in any way going to impact on people's current services, but we will want to continue to work with people to ensure that those services are better able going forward to reach more people.
Will there be a reduction in staffing then, which also requires a different look at the way service is delivered?
The changes we're making will mean that there are different roles in the organisation, and as a result of that, there is likely to be some change both in the numbers of staff and the roles that staff play. So yes, the honest answer is that these changes are likely to result in a reduction in the numbers of staff. But we're talking relatively small numbers compared to those that are employed. And of course, there are also our 5,000 volunteers that provide huge value to our community.
In terms of services then, are there services which require closer scrutiny to improve the way they've been performing so far?
No, it's not about closer scrutiny. It's just making sure that actually they're delivered in a consistent way. For instance, if we were to talk about what RNIB does to support people into employment, that would look different depending on where people live. So if you lived in Cornwall, for instance, your experience of RNIB would look very, very different to if you were receiving services in a different part of the UK. We want RNIB to be known across the UK for its excellent services. So what we want to do is to think differently about, for instance, our employment service, and make sure that we can be really confident about talking about our offer and also those provided by other people.
Okay, another thing we've looked at on Connect Radio, on R&B Connect Radio for some time, is the new Connect ethos, if you like. So connecting up not just the organisation, but the service users as well. How does that fit into the sort of new structure then? How will connecting people improve?
I'm hugely excited about this, the opportunities the new way of working will give us here, because you're absolutely right. Connecting people with each other, connecting people to services is what this change is about. It's about valuing and respecting the fact that lived experience of living with sight loss and the ability to support each other as part of a connected community, the benefits that brings to the community as a whole. What we want to do is invest in that. We want to ensure that the community feels and is confident in sharing its skills with other members of the community. And in that respect, I suppose, kind of give back. It's really kind of taking the concept of being an organisation of blind and partially sighted people to the next level, reaching new heights, I think, in terms of a connected community, bringing together the best of what that connection can offer with the services that RNIB and others provide. So, yeah, hugely excited at the potential and opportunity around the community.
What about working with more grassroots organisations, you know, smaller charities who are within communities and probably have a closer link with people who live in their areas?
A really important point, and thank you for asking that question, because I said earlier that when we're looking at our services, that looks different depending on where you are in the UK. And of course, we know that across the UK there is different organisations who are providing fantastic services day in, day out for blind and partially sighted people. What we need to do is make sure that we're playing our part as a national organisation, and our part is connecting people to those services, those much valued services. At the moment, we know that people simply do not know what is available to them. We can play a much bigger part in ensuring people are connected to local services.
There's a big picture here about improving the service and making RNIB more accessible to the service users and really getting them to direct what we do. Has coming to this stage of changes, has that been difficult for you and the Board of Trustees? Because there obviously has been some difficult decisions to take.
The difficult decisions that the board and I and the executive team have had to make is around some of the challenges and hard and difficult world out there for charities, and we need to cut our cloth to fit. We need to make sure that services are sustainable going forward if we're promoting a different way of doing things. The last thing we'd want to do is to make changes only then to find that we can't deliver on those promises. So making sure that the organisation is sustainable going forward has required us to make some difficult decisions in some cases about what we fund and what we don't fund. However, the service model and the changes we're making, actually they've been a lot easier decisions to make on the basis of the evidence that we're relying on to make those changes. We've been working with staff, we've been working with customers, we have a customer council, for instance, who's really helped to shape proposals. We've done some what's called kind of prototyping, which is looking and exploring kind of how things might work, testing things out to see what the changes might look like. And as a result of all that evidence, actually there is a really strong confidence in the changes we're making. And because of that, we're able to actually make that decision. That decision's made, and is a lot easier to make as a result.
I'm highlighting the changes, that there have been several changes over the past few years, and it's purely because this has been a concern of many of the service users as well, that this recent change, it is pretty big. You know, this is organisational wide. When the changes are implemented, can you see a period of calm when things will start to bed in, and how will they be assessed?
I hope so. You asked earlier, and I responded by saying this change is holistic. And I think in that sense, whilst that makes it bigger right now, it also means that it is more likely to be a change that we can, once done, start to build on and test and ensure it is sustainable and works. And I think key to that, and again, a really important factor, is the fact that we need to be alive, constantly alive, to what the community of blind and partially sighted people are telling us. We need to use that feedback to shape everything that comes next. If we can get that right, then I'm very confident any change going forward will absolutely be valued and respected by the community, as I say, that we're here to support.
You're acting as the interim chief executive at the moment, Sally. What's it like being in that role at the time you came into it? And, you know, I don't want to say thrown in at the deep end, but you've come into a very big period of change.
It is a big period of change, and that's both exciting but also daunting in terms of leading that. I've got a great team. I think RNIB, the one thing that, you know, I'm jumping around here, Alan, but I've been with RNIB now just coming up 8 years. The consistent thing that for me makes it a fantastic organisation to work for, actually there's two things. It's being connected with a community of blind and partially sighted people, that connection with the people we're here to support, but also the passion and commitment of our staff. In that respect, actually, the decisions I'm having to make are a lot easier because I know that there is that support for making a difference to people's lives that I can rely on. So in that respect, it's a huge privilege and a very exciting opportunity to be leading RNIB.
In terms of service, we've obviously discussed the ways that you're looking to improve that frontline service. We've looked at the ways of connecting the service users and in driving what RNIB does as an organisation further. What about staff input as well? Because at the end of the day, they are the people who are delivering the service and you're wanting them to deliver that service as best they possibly can.
Absolutely. Staff have been involved in a number of ways in terms of shaping the new operating model. What we also know, and I think an important point to draw out when I said earlier that currently we only reach around 100,000 people directly. Now, against a backdrop of 2 million people living with sight loss, that's a small handful. So we need to ensure that, as well as working with our staff and our existing customers about shaping the services that people want, we also need to be very aware of actually and ask ourselves a question about why RNIB is not supporting more people. Are the services we're providing, are they less relevant to those people? What do they want? So we need to ensure that their voice is heard and that we ensure that going forward, we take account of both our existing customers, really important that we don't forget our existing customers, but equally that we're relevant to the many, many thousands more people who are not provided any support at all at the moment. And the voice of customer and staff need to shape that.
Sally, we'd love it if you would come back and speak with us again in a few months' time once the changes are implemented and the ball is rolling to look back at that and perhaps look forward again from this new position. You happy to do that?
Absolutely. It'd be my absolute pleasure.
Sally, thank you for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much, Alan.
So there you go, Sally Harvey there, Acting Chief Exec of RNIB, speaking there to Alan Russell. And if you want to hear more of that interview, you can go to the RNIB podcast. All you have to do is search for that on Audioboom. You can also get it on iTunes. And if you have a comment or a view on what you've heard, and we would be very keen to hear your thoughts on this, and, you know, what the changes mean for RNIB, what they might mean for you as a user of the service as well, get in touch with us, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. And if you'd like to feature in next week's programme to talk about those changes, we'd be very happy to hear from you. theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. This is the place where you can talk about anything. No subject is off limits, even RNIB. You can come on and talk about them as much or as little as you wish. That's your programme. Now, coming up, we're going to talk about employment and the difficulties one woman's had with self-employment.
Coming soon to RNIB Connect Radio, the book group.
I read Braille under the bedclothes. My wife hates that, by the way, because you've got to lift the duvet up to turn the page.
I do that sometimes.
Can you relate to that?
With RNIB talk and support, we listen in to a telephone book group.
when I first had my talking boots from the RNIB. It was the big old, and many of you remember them, the big old players with the sort of like 8-track cassettes, like the...
I remember
huge
those.
Great things they were.
And ginormous, not the least bit portable.
RNIB Talk and Support run telephone social groups for adults with sight loss. There are tele-befriending groups which help you socialise by phone for friendship and support. Or you can share your passion for books and reading by taking part in a telephone book club.
It just shows how some books just endure, don't they, over decades and
time.
Yeah. You know, I would take all the books that people have mentioned, you know, the Jane Eyre, The Pride and Prejudice, I would take all of them. With the diary, I would take them all on my desert island. Can I have them?
No, you wouldn't be allowed to, though.
One book other than the Bible and the Shakespeare.
The book group on RNIB Connect Radio. Tuesday the 7th of March at 6 p.m. and Saturday the 11th of March at 8 a.m.
The Weekly Connect. The Weekly Connect. On RNIB Connect Radio.
And there's more coming up on the book group. In fact, a chance to get a bit of a preview of what's coming up in that programme and how you can get involved as well. That's to come here on the Weekly Connect this week. Now, lots of you talking about employment on the programme, and a few of you have been in touch to give your suggestions on self-employment. Of course, that is a big area of concern for a lot of people. What kind of services are available? I mean, is access to work available for someone with self-employment? It certainly seems by the responses we've had over the past couple of weeks, the answer to that is no. Well, is that good enough? Is that something that needs to be made aware of? Well, Alex Mackey has been in touch with us because she wanted to share her story of self-employment, but also she wanted to talk to us about the recent consultation the government held into getting more disabled people into work. She has filled in the consultation. Of course, that has now ended. It ended on February 17th, but she was keen to share her views on why we all need to make our positions more clearer on employment as disabled people. And she spoke to our own Sophia Asif.
They need to know the exact reasons why we are not getting work, the exact reasons behind what the problems are with systems of access to work or education into work. The structure of how we get jobs these days is set against us, really, particularly with the growth of internet-based systems where people just don't seem to have any interest in making it accessible to those using speech or large, you know, or trying to make it into large print. I don't think that many people actually care. I'll give you an example. I went to the job centre and I asked for help in searching for a job on the internet. They said, do you not have a helper with you? Now, I know this seems a bit unreasonable, but don't you think that they shouldn't be asking me these things? Do you not think that they should be the ones to help me? They should be the ones to know that they've got speech software inbuilt on their computers. They should be the ones to be telling me how I can do that. Because it seems to me that the job centre merely types up a report on who has work and who doesn't and actually doesn't actually aid people into work. And as a teenager, I always thought that a job centre would be a place where you could go and they could give you advice on how to get a job, what jobs are out there, and how to build up the skills to get into a job. And I don't really see why we're paying them, if I'm honest.
I think that's a very fair point, actually, and very well made. If you were to think of, you know, the top, I don't know, 3 or 5 reasons why the visually impaired community find it hard to find out about work that might suit their skills or find it hard to get into work. Do you think you could list those for me?
There are 5 top reasons, at least, as to why the visually impaired are not getting into work. One of them that I would put at the top is health and safety rubbish. And the reason why I would say that is because we are obliged to consider health and safety, don't get me wrong, but a lot of people use it as an excuse to exclude people under these days. I'll give you an example. A friend of mine works in a laundress. He is blind and he folds up clothes for a living. Due to health and safety, he is not allowed to walk up steps within the work that he does. Now, you could argue that I was ignorant, but I do think that blind people can walk up steps. I mean, I do it every single day, and I just think that's an excuse to stop him from getting other occupation that happens to be up a set of stairs. The second reason that I would say is through sheer fear factor. At the end of the day, we are in a culture of suing people for the smallest of accidents. Like, we hear on the news about people suing the council for a paving slab not being put down, or suing, let's say, a big company like Beamish for somebody else's dog biting their child. Now, you may disagree with me, but I do believe that it's about time that society reminds itself why it is a society, and that is because individuals take responsibility for themselves, not just imposing, you know, things on people that may or may not be necessary. But I also do think that as a result of the "we are going to sue you" crisis that we have at the moment, the attitude towards disabilities and taking people and things on that they don't really understand or know about becomes ever so much more frightening for them, so we're far less likely to get any occupation. The third reason that I think that we are not in work is because of education. I was a person who gave out visual impairment awareness training throughout my life, and as a job to the guys, the primary schools, the secondary schools. And I was recently talking to Irish Access, who does the same thing. So if you're interested, go for it. But the point is that because of health and safety, and because of people's attitude towards their children seeing people with disabilities, that they feel it's not a very nice thing to see as a child. I'm thinking, well, how do you think a person who is a child feels with that disability in that same school? Because we all expected to go to the same schools nowadays. We don't really have disability schools around nowadays. We're expected to get on in state schools and be taught by state schools, who, let's face it, don't really know or understand how to tackle this particular disability. And it is a very hard disability to tackle. So it's about education as well, and trying to lower the fear factor down. The fourth reason is because we have very little access, in my opinion, to jobs that we can see as blind people being accessible to blind people. I know it sounds biased, but as a teenager, we all have role models. And for a visually impaired person, a visually impaired role model is what we need. And we need our role models as children and as adults, because we can say, well, that person has the same disability as me, so it must be possible for me to get that occupation. That person is, let's say, that person is black and in a drama performance, therefore I, as a black person, might be able to get into a drama performance myself. But how many disabled people do you see on television that aren't wanting to commit suicide, or aren't feeling bad about themselves, or who aren't committing crime? You just don't see it anymore.
Yeah, it's a very good point, actually. And the last one?
The last one is because there are very, very few blind people out there now. We have more or less cured most of the eyesight conditions that, let's face it, we had in 1913, and we had a lot more job opportunities in 1913, let me tell you that, as a person who worked at Beamish, than we do nowadays. And when you get a lower population of people with that particular disability, then it stands to reason that not many people are going to know about it. And because of the economics of society and how much money you would make by making equipment for blind and partially sighted people, with a lower population, it becomes more expensive. People are less likely to buy, let's say, a £1,100 scanner that speaks and can export to Word documents, for example, than a normal sighted person. You know, we're less likely to buy it because we're all on benefits. We don't make enough money.
Can we just spin it round now and ask, you know, why do you think employers are reluctant?
I think employers are reluctant to take us on because we threaten them, let's be honest. You know, we threaten people with disability discrimination if we're refused access to places. We threaten them with legal action if, you know, suing them if we trip over something as a society nowadays. So they might not want to take people like us who are threatening to them, but they also don't want to take on a great big bill and a lot of extra hard work. Because let's face it, getting that extra equipment, and if you say to any employer, by the way, I used a Clear Reader Plus, which is a scanner that reads the print out to me and saves documents on a memory stick that costs $2,500, their jaw drops and they look at you like, and how much is it going to cost me to take you on?
What about support for employers? Are you aware of any support for employers to employ people with visual impairments?
Blind in Business are there, and they actively support employers in taking someone on. But it's obviously changed from when I was about 14, because when I was 14 and I was told about Blind in Business, thanks to my school and my parents, which is one of the best things they did for me, they said that Blind in Business aids employers in buying equipment. And the fact is that they don't. That's quite misleading. It's actually access to work. But because of ignorance, it's incredibly hard to get access to work, pay for a personal assistant these days. And because it's a recession time, it's probably too difficult.
Do you think
the employers don't really get much of a chance, do they, really?
So let's talk a little bit about access to work and how do we make employers more aware of it?
How do we get employers to know about access to work is a very good question. And personally, I think one way that we can do it is to say about it in an interview. You know, when they've asked all the questions, just take a moment to say, look, have you got any questions for me and how I'm going to do this job? Because if you are unsure, don't be afraid. I'm not going to sue you. I just want to know what questions you've got about my disability or about anything that you like, and to just ask me them. And that's when you could put access to work in. But I should also say that it's very hard to get someone to take to you when on your CV you've put you're blind or partially sighted, because if they don't know in the first place, they are going to prefer somebody else other than you. So a lot of my friends say, don't bother putting your name, you know, don't bother telling them that you're blind until you're in the interview stage. And I'm increasingly starting to think that they are correct in that fact.
It's one of those things like your date of birth. A lot of people say don't put your date of birth on your CV because it should be about kind of what skills and experience and, you know, what your strengths are off the CV. OK, you have your own business and you decided that actually rather than going into work for another person, you decided that working for yourself was the best solution for you. Or did you always want to work for yourself anyway?
I chose to work for myself because I increasingly get frustrated with how negative people are when it comes to employing me specifically as a partially sighted and blind person. But I also felt that it was the best employment for me, because I'm never going to give myself gross dismissal now, am I, really? You know, I'm never going to give myself a bad review when I leave work, because if I don't work for myself, then I don't get paid. So it's a pretty simple way of life, and it makes things a lot easier in terms of being able to decide on your own times of work. It's got a lot of flexibility when you're disabled to be self-employed. You can, in theory, get access to work for self-employment, so that's a bonus. And I felt it was the right route for me when thinking about all my health conditions.
Okay, and do you get help with things, I don't know, like tax returns, or how do you manage the management of your business?
If I'm honest, I get a lot of access to work, but not from access to work. I get it from my parents. My parents act as my eyes, and although many people would say that changes your relationship, if you've got the right work ethic, you are merely working together. You are not having family disputes in a work environment. So my dad helps me with that technological side that I haven't had the education for. I didn't start using speech software until sixth form because my secondary school told me that blind people couldn't use a computer.
That was good of them.
They could expect me to turn up to IT lessons, of course, but...
Yeah, I bet. Well, thank you to Alex Mackey there for sharing her views, to Sophia Asif here on The Weekly Connect. You can share your thoughts on what Alex has said. She's quite a lot in there, of course, and I'm sure you might want to pick out some of that to comment on. You can do that at The Weekly Connect at rnib.org.uk. Now, The Book Group is a new programme coming soon to RNIB Connect Radio, and here's a bit of a taster of what's to come and how you can get involved.
I've chosen a book outside of my genre that I mentioned earlier. I've chosen a book not from the crime thriller catalogue or the travel catalogue. Mm-hmm. I've chosen a book that was written over 100 years ago, I believe in the 1890s, and it's called The Diary of Nobody.
Oh, yeah.
By George and Whedon Grossmith. I read it, or listen to it, rather, at least once a year. It cheers me up. It really, all it is, it's such a simple story. It's not a long book. I think the audio version is only about 4 hours. Basically, what it's about, Iona, is a family, the Pooter family, Charles Pooter, head of house, and his family living in what's regarded as a suburb, but it's Holloway in London. I mean, I don't regard Holloway as a suburb of London now. It's very much a business part of North London. But in the Victorian time, when this was written, it was regarded as a suburb. And it's a gentle satire, very understated humour about a lower middle class family. He's a clerk in the city, and really it's about their life. And running in the background is obviously a social commentary of the period, which is just before Victoria died. It's fantastic humour. It makes me laugh out loud at times. It brings a smile to my face without realising I'm smiling while I'm listening. That's why I read it once a year, because it really lifts the spirits. It cheers me up. It also proves to me that the best laid plans of man can go wrong. I mean, he's trying to... everything he does, Charles Pooter, for himself and his family, it tends to go wrong, and sometimes acutely embarrassing. I mean, toe-curlingly embarrassing, you know, from dealing with tradesmen like the butcher and the ironmonger, from being invited to the guild hall and having a dance with his wife Carrie on the dance floor. But I won't spoil it for people, but it's the humour in it is running right through it. And, of course, tragedy is not far from humour, or embarrassment is never too far from which, as a blind person, you can really relate to, because we get into some situations that are not funny at the time, but they're funny on reflection.
Yeah.
I thoroughly recommend this book. As I said, I don't think you'd be disappointed. It doesn't really fit in any genre. I think it started life in Punch magazine. in 1888, and it was so popular that it was then turned into this book, which has stood the test of time. And this type of book written in the 1890s can still make you smile and laugh in the 21st century. I think that says a lot for the writing, doesn't it?
Let's have a listen to the book as available from RNIB.
April the 3rd. Tradesmen called for custom, and I promised Farmerson, the ironmonger, to give him a turn if I wanted any nails or tools. By the by, that reminds me, there's no key to our bedroom door. And the bells must be seen to. The parlour bell is broken, and the front door rings up in the servant's bedroom, which is ridiculous. Dear friend Going dropped in, but wouldn't stay, saying there was an infernal smell of paint. April the 4th. Tradesmen still calling. Carrie being out, I arranged to deal with Horwin, who seemed a civil butcher with a nice clean shop. Ordered a shoulder of mutton for tomorrow to give him a trial. Carrie arranged with Borsett, the butter man, and ordered a pound of fresh butter, and a pound and a half of salt ditto for kitchen, and a shilling's worth of eggs. In the evening, Cummings unexpectedly dropped in to show me a meerschaum pipe he'd won in a raffle in the city, and told me to handle it carefully, as it would spoil the colouring if the hand was moist. He said he wouldn't stay, as he didn't care much for the smell of the paint, and fell over the scraper as he went out. Must get the scraper removed, or else I shall get into a scrape. I don't often make jokes.
That book is, of course, available from RNIB Talking Books. Now let's rejoin the conversation on the book group on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you, Alan. Your enthusiasm really shone through there.
I mean, Jane Eyre is a fantastic pick by David. I love Jane Eyre. But I think if on my desert island, Charles Pooter and his family and the Diary of a Nobody is coming with me.
Well, there you go. Just a teaser of what is to come on the book group, which kicks off Tuesday. That is March 7th at 6 p.m. Or you can listen to it Saturday at the 11th at 8 a.m. Or it's always available as a podcast as well on RNIB Connect Radio, on Audioboom and iTunes. Quick note on the Disabled Access Weekend that is coming up this weekend. Some venues need to be booked in advance. Some venues are running specifically visually impaired orientated tours. Buckingham Palace, for one. Want to know more? Well, you can find out more at disabledaccessday.com. That is it for The Weekly Connect this week. Keep in touch. The Weekly Connect at rnib.org.uk. Remember, if it's Mondays at 1, it's The Weekly Connect. Thanks for listening.